speaking today with Gail Fallon, who is the president of the Houston Federation of Teachers. Gail, has been a lot of school-related news lately, and I want to talk to you about some of these things.
Definitely.
Let's just start out kind of generally by asking, what is your evaluation of the state of HISD, and what do you think the top priorities should be for its new superintendent, Terry Greer?
Well, I think right now one of the biggest problems HISD has is its new superintendent, Terry Greer. Because what we have seen is an unwillingness to listen to parents, an unwillingness to listen to teachers, an unwillingness to listen to community leaders, and they are our schools. You know, we do pay taxes for them, and we have a definite interest in how they're doing. We do have some problems. We have a tremendously high dropout rate. We're still turning out students that aren't reading on grade level. And share all of the urban problems that we see around the country.
What would be your preference for how he should go about attacking those problems?
Well, it depends on which problem. If you want,
let's start dropouts and performance.
First of all, a student drops out for several reasons. They either have an economic need at home to go to work, and our teachers see that all the time. That's the child whose parents tell them, you know, you're 16, go get a good job. I mean, I had one of those students live with me and my husband for several years because his dad wanted him to go get a good job at Kroger and he wanted to finish school. Because the child finds nothing relevant in what he's doing. Or because the child has gotten so hopelessly behind that he's not going to catch up and every day that he's in a classroom is pure torture. Now, there are solutions to those, and I think a lot of them we're going to work out at the legislature. One of them, when you look at the fact that our children are not reading on grade level, there's a very interesting set of statistics. When you look at the NAEP data, and that's kind of the gold standard for how school districts are doing nationally, our elementary students are reading on grade level, and somehow they get into high school, they're 3-4 grade levels behind in reading. Well, there was an interesting thing that happened in Texas in 1997. We took reading out of the middle schools. And a lot of parents didn't realize it. We saw it happening and couldn't stop it. And I've had Mike Moses admit at least once that it was one of the worst mistakes that he saw the state make when he was commissioner. What it used to be was you'd go into a 6th, 7th, or 8th grade classroom, regardless of whether you were a low-performing or a high-performing student, you took a double language block. You took an English block and you took a reading block. And they were each separate periods. But the biggest problem was we couldn't find reading teachers. There weren't enough certified. So rather than motivate people to certify in reading, we just said, well, we'll just teach reading in the English classes because there was no shortage of secondary English teachers. The only problem is a secondary English teacher has never taken a reading course in their life, a methods course, and no clue for the most part how to teach reading. So what we saw happen was we saw a significant drop in the ability of students to read when they got into high school. Because what they do considerably in the reading courses in middle school is vocabulary development. And there have been a number of research studies, one classic one by the Rand Corporation, saying if a child doesn't come from a vocabulary-rich home, he's not going to develop vocabulary on his own. It's going to have to be taught. Well, we stop teaching it, and then we take children who are raised in poverty, who don't necessarily have a lot of books in the home, don't have a vocabulary-rich home, and throw them into high school without having taught them the vocabulary. That's not a hard fix. It's just no one's doing it. We have talked to some of the legislators. I know Rob Eisler, who chairs House Ed, is somewhat focused on that. The other thing we do is when we get to the vocational courses or career and technology, we don't really start doing much there until 11th, 12th grade. And at that point, we've probably lost them. So for the child who's not necessarily going to go to college or may only be able to at least start college at you know, if he can work at the same time, you basically lost him at the end of ninth grade. He's not interested in what he's taking. He's got an economic need, and he doesn't see any relevance. What we've been talking to the legislature about is one of the things we do right now for our academically, the students who are looking toward college is we give dual credit at the community college in junior and senior year. There's no reason we can't do that for their career and technology courses. I mean, they, unfortunately, I think what we suffer from is the stereotype with people, you know, 40 and above, who often are the decision makers, that career and tech is the old home ec and auto mechanics for the slow kids, when it's anything but. It's the med tech fields, it's the high tech computer industry. And I talked to the chancellor at HCC, and she said they've got, I think she said, 28 certification courses there that lead to very high paying jobs. But we do none of that in dual credit. That would give a child a reason to stay in school. And then possibly we could move our career and tech courses down into the ninth grade and possibly even the career awareness into the eighth grade so that the child sees that there is something out there I'm interested in, and it is a ticket to a middle-income lifestyle, and I need to stay here. And at the same time, you're showing the parent who may want their child to leave school, look, if he stays here, it's the difference between minimum wage and $30, $40 an hour. And it also meets where Texas is going. I was on the Governor's Competitiveness Council, which was really an analysis of what jobs Texas is going to have. And we listened to CEO after CEO stand up in the sectors that will develop in Texas for med tech, energy, and say, look, 90% of our new jobs are going to take a 2-year community college certification, not a 4-year degree. And they said, we recruit college graduates nationally. So we're seeing a little bit of a disconnect between where the schools are and where the jobs are going to be. And the kids see that too.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about teacher evaluations, since that has been controversial.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, the HFT has issues with the plan that Superintendent Greer and the board has put forth to allow for teachers to be dismissed based on student evaluations. Let me start by asking, I mean, obviously you disagree with this, you know, what is the best way to evaluate a teacher?
Well, first of all, HISD had enough policy to use student test scores to some degree. State law governs how a teacher is evaluated. We didn't fight them when they put standardized test scores in there. They're just not the only criteria. And that's the problem we have with them right now. The best way to evaluate is to get out of your office as an administrator and go in and observe. You can also look at the data. You can look at the pass-fail rate. You can look at the standardized test rate. But if you look at the standardized test rate, you have to consider the level that the child came in. If I got a child in my ninth grade English class, and he's still reading on a fifth or sixth grade level, he's probably not going to do real well on the tax. But the question is, you know, was that 100% my fault? I mean, where we've got an issue is, first of all, a good bit of the way HISD is doing this is not understood by the teachers, nor can it be. It's not just taking raw test scores and saying, okay, let's look at the 30 kids that you have, where they were, and where they ended up. And unfortunately, when you talk value added, it has an intuitive appeal to people because they say, oh, wow, well, that makes sense. How much value did you add? Well, you better have a better measure than the Bill Sanders method, because what he does is he has a formula, which is public if you understand doctoral level math, and what isn't public, however, is how the formula is utilized and the computer codes that he uses. So consequently, no teacher who even has all of their student test data, can duplicate in any way or replicate Hal Sanders gets what he calls his EBOT number, which is their evaluation based on their test scores. The other problem we have is timing. Okay, let's say I give the tax to my kids in March. I'm going to get my test results in June, or actually in late May. I'm not going to get my EVAS, or my value added number, from Bill Sanders until the following December. What good has that now done me? Do I know what I did right or wrong? I mean, teachers regard it as somewhat, when it was just bonuses, they just laughed at it and said, well, it's like winning the lottery. We don't know what we did. It's like scratching off a number and you got a bonus. They just raised the stakes considerably. And it's not just the union criticizing it. I went online, looked at all the research studies done on value added. The only ones that I could find that supported this program were the ones done by the company that's making a bloody fortune selling it. That's SAS.
Okay.
Rand Corporation did a literature study, looked at all the studies, and said, we want to caution against using it as a sole determinant. And that is exactly what HISD is doing. In spite of what Superintendent Greer is publicly saying, which is, oh, well, no teacher is going to be fired just on their test scores, he's just put out a memo to his principals telling them that use any one of the 34 criteria that we have for determining whether to keep a teacher. And the new criteria, item 34, is insufficient student academic growth as reflected by value-added scores. That means he'll fire them just based on that. Now, the other interesting thing is TEA has ruled on this once because Dallas took a case up there. And what they've said is if you're going to say the teacher is a sole determining factor in no progress in that class, then you better be able to show that there are no other factors. And they overturned the Dallas case and put the teacher back to work because they said it was a dysfunctional school. I mean, and to me that's fair. I've seen very few social issues that have a sole determinant. You know, social issues are complex. There's multiple causation. The method that HISD uses jumps to a sole causative factor, and that being the teacher. And that's absurd.
All right. Let's move to another issue. I think you covered about everything I would have asked in there. So let's move to the issue of Community Education Partners, CEP, which is the alternate school that the students are sent to for certain types of discipline issues.
Correct, disciplinary alternative school.
Let's start with a basic question. You know, what is the purpose of CEP? When a student is sent there, is it intended to be punitive, rehabilitative, or something else?
Actually, it's kind of interesting because the state law created the disciplinary alternative education programs. And what we saw a lot of school districts doing was very cheap. They warehoused them. Nothing's cheaper than putting them out in the temporary building somewhere with a teacher and telling the other teacher send work. All it does is guarantees that child gets further and further behind every day he's out there. Rod Page brought in CEP, and we were a little skeptical initially because it's a private company. And unions are not prone to like anything that's privatization of a public school system. However, what his goal was he said there's nothing crueler to a child than these 10 to 30 day placements that just take him out of class and do nothing. What he wanted was something that would solve multiple problems. One, it would take the disruptive child out of class so the teacher could teach. Two, it would work on the child's behavior so that when he came back, you had a better behaved child. And he understood what his issues were. And three, an academic program that would build his skills. And that's what we have in this program.
Now,
it's not meant as punishment. The biggest problem we have is to the public, their view is, do the crime, do the time, so let's do a shorter time. You know, and no parent is happy hearing their kids going to a disciplinary alternative, whether it's CEP or another one. But what we find is they have a lot of very loyal parents once the child gets there because they see them helping their child.
Now, I'm doing a little research on this, and the Houston Press has written a number of articles about CEP. And
yes, none of them they've been able to substantiate, but...
it's interesting. In the articles that they mentioned, and I will say most of the ones I saw dated from, you know, 7, 8, 9 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But they were saying that exactly what you were saying, it's not supposed to be, that the kids were being warehoused, they weren't doing anything, they weren't making progress towards their academic goals, you know.
Well, actually, the data that the district has and the data that the company has doesn't support that. Generally, it shows that they get grade level promotion, they earn course credits, and one of the things CEP does that you aren't going to see in many schools, when the child comes in, there's a one-week orientation. And we're relatively familiar with the program because we're the bargaining agent. We decided, if you're going to bring in a private company, we're going to just organize them. So I have a staff rep that's over there constantly. And if there's a problem, the teachers bring it to us. We've heard the allegation that their teachers aren't certified. We went and checked. Yes, they are. In fact, they probably have more teachers totally certified than HISD does. So they have fewer, you know, first-year people coming in that are doing alternative certification. But the child gets there, the parent has to come with them, they give the parent a complete orientation of what the program is like, what to expect. As far as the child, they next do diagnostic testing to find out what his grade levels are. And they put him in courses, but they also have a remedial lab in each learning community. And if they're behind in reading, they will put them on a program at their grade level to build their reading skills. If they're behind in math, they'll do the same thing. And they'll put them in to a regular classroom where they get direct instruction from the teacher. They're grouped by grade level. They do separate. They have the boys' learning communities and the girls' learning communities, which removes a distraction. They also have a very large social service component. So when you go in there, you go down to the social service component. Let's say a child has an anger management problem, which a number of them do. They're going to send the child down. They're going to hook them up with the right county or city or social service agency to assist with that in counseling. But at the same time, maybe they find the family's about to be evicted. There are medical problems in the family. It's a one-stop. The parent comes in, and they'll say, okay, well, we can also bring this agency, and these people to help with your foreclosure. So, you know, by the time they finish, they've dealt with all of the problems the child's dealing with. We don't have a single school in HISD that can do that. In fact, we don't have a social worker for every secondary school or even every feeder pattern in HISD where, you know, what the company learned was they can, if they give space to the social service agencies, they're there. I mean, you look and there are, you know, you look at it and there are like 19 or 20 different agencies on each campus that are coming in routinely and helping. I mean, the last time I was out, there was a child who and his family there that they were, one of the teen suicide prevention groups was in there dealing with a problem with a child. There was another one where someone was coming in to deal with their anger management problems. And it's kind of an amazing thing to watch because they're dealing with the whole family. The primary reason that CEP gets students extended in their stay there is not that they did something wrong. Parent request. And the district, after a while, will turn the parent down and say, no, they've got to go back to a regular school. My godson went there. If it wasn't a good program, I'd send him to a private school. But little Mr. Persistent Misconduct went over there. And it did wonders. We found out that his reading level was low. Within 4 months, he was reading on grade level. And I could actually get him to read a book rather than just humor me and look at it. I extended him. I kept him there for a year and a half. They finally made me send him back to a regular school.
Okay. One of the things that Superintendent Greer has said is that some of the kids that are in CEP are there for, you know, for minor infractions. Now, you've sent me some data that I've examined that about how many students get referred, and the number overall is relatively low. It's less than 4% of all disciplinary
right.
incidents. So, you know, as you've told me, a student will be sent there for level 4 infractions, which are
mandatory. So those are
felony-type things.
Well, those are what they're calling the zero tolerance. And, of course, you have proof. The liberal groups don't like zero tolerance. Not that that phrase appears anywhere in state law, but there is a law that says if a child threatens the life of his teacher, brings weapons on campus, and we're not talking, you know, he's got the pocket knife or he's forgotten brought his nail clippers. The way the law reads, weapons defined in the penal code as a felony. Drugs defined in the penal code as a felony. So, you know, do we have problems in the suburban districts subverting that law? Yeah, I mean, we have KDISD that sends kids over there for the nail file and aspirin and tries to call it zero tolerance, which inflames everyone, but in HISD, we just do the serious ones. We've got enough real weapons and real drugs on campus, and, of course, assaults on teachers, terroristic threats, other felony behavior. Now, our level threes are not minor offenses. This is not the kid who refuses to tuck his shirt tail in. This is the child that is so repeatedly disruptive that the teacher cannot conduct a class effectively. And, you know, I look at Greer saying we're going to hold you responsible for student performance, but he wants to weaken discipline in the schools. You know, that makes absolutely no sense. You know, the teacher under state law has a right to remove a disruptive child from class. The principal under state law can convene the discipline committee and override the teacher once. The second time that child comes out, he's got to do another placement. And it takes, on average, according to HISD's numbers, 5 to 7 serious offenses before the child ends up going over to CEP. So the only one-time offender is the child that's got the gun in his backpack or the marijuana on him and gets caught. Other than that, these persistent ones are the ones where the teacher has finally said, okay, you're on your 5th referral to the office. Do something with this child. He's taking up half my class period.
Okay. Going back a little farther, as you know, Governor Perry made news when he instructed the Texas Education Association to not apply for the so-called Race to the Top funds for schools. However, school districts have the option to do that themselves. What is your opinion of this?
Well, I think the most surprised I've ever seen the Houston Press Corps was when they walked into that press conference and saw me standing beside Governor Perry. Because, you know, they don't perceive unions as supporting what he does. I don't look at political party, I look at political issues. We agreed with him on the Race to the Top funds. Well, we looked at the analysis that the Texas Education Agency had done on the record keeping that it was going to require. I mean, it was so severe that half the money coming down to each school district would stay at the agency just to create departments to handle the record keeping for the federal data. And it allowed half of the money that came to the school district to stay with the school district because of the extra people they were going to have to hire. And it hit us pretty quickly who was going to be doing the original collecting of the data. And my people have enough paperwork. They don't need it. The other problem we looked at is, okay, it's one-time money, but the requirements are for as long as the law exists. So we have one-time money that we put into program. We have to set up this expensive record keeping. Well, who pays for the record keeping year 2, year 3, year 4? We do. I don't want my tax money going there. I want it going on the kids. And, you know, it made absolutely no sense to potentially indebt school districts that are already whining that they're not getting enough money coming down. And at the same time, burden teachers with this excessive paperwork. I mean, people really had to read what that law said, read the requirements of the grant. And it was, some money isn't worth it. And that money purely wasn't worth it to us. And, you know, we supported Perry on that. Now, one of the things that's going to be very interesting is, let's say HISD were to apply for it, or any Texas school district, and they get the Race to the Top money. They're still required to do the state standards as well as now the new federal core standards that they're looking at. We're spending enough time teaching the test. If we have to teach two tests, we don't have any time for the curriculum. And we have already seen the curriculum narrow to the point that a number of parents don't want their kids in public schools. I don't have one of my neighbors on my street sending their kid to HISD, and it's not because they think the teachers are bad. It's not that they think the schools are unsafe. It's because that's all they do is teach the test, and I don't want my kid to just learn to bubble in. And Race to the Top is going to make it considerably worse.
Okay. Since we're talking money, you know, as you know, state allocations to school districts were frozen at 2006 levels, and the state is currently in financial difficulties. A lot of school districts themselves are feeling a squeeze as, you know, enrollments rise, costs go up. What needs to be done to fix this?
We need to completely revamp school finance. And having been through several of those legislative sessions, in fact, the delightful two-year period where we did God knows how many special sessions along with regular sessions and ended up with Robin Hood, I almost hate saying that because it's a nightmare when you go up to the legislature. School finance is so complicated, very few of them really understand it. I mean, we have a standing joke that other than possibly Scott Hochberg and a couple of consultants, there's no one in the state that really understands the state funding formulas. But they really do have to be redone. I mean, and we really need to look at the tax structure in Texas as to whether the property tax is an effective way to raise money for schools. I know inside the loop, you could probably get a number of people saying, let's look at some other tax structure. Because it almost gets to the point that you can't afford to keep your house. And we're still underfunding our schools. HISD has not had some of the problems of the other districts. Because at the point that they froze our levels, our enrollment was considerably higher than it is now. And we had the Katrina kids in. And we are a declining enrollment school district, particularly as, and probably will continue to decline due to the gentrification and the growth of the charter schools inside HISD. I know it's given a horrible problem to David Anthony out in Cy-Fair because the current funding formulas do not work at all for a rapidly growing district. And, you know, I feel for him. I've seen what he's going through, and it's horrible.
Okay. Just to wrap this up, you know, to kind of refer back to the original question, if there was one thing you could have HISD do to improve, you know, anything at all, what would you have them do?
Actually, it's what I would stop having them do. I would have them do a very careful analysis, looking at real research, and stop doing fads. Stop looking for the silver bullet that's going to fix it. Because it doesn't exist. And what we end up with are feel-good programs that get changed every time we change board or change superintendent. I mean, we need to do a complete... Yeah, first of all, we need to look at a K-14 system minimally.
What's a K-14 system?
That's incorporating either some level of vocational training, the community college, into a coordinated program. Not saying take over the community college, but coordinating. And And making sure particularly that our high schools become far more relevant to kids. You know, one of the comments I'll never forget was a comment made at a workshop in Austin where the speaker stood up and said, the American high school is probably the only place that Rip Van Winkle could wake up and feel perfectly comfortable 100 years later. Because we haven't changed it. It looks the way it did when I went to school. Only the jobs don't look the same. And we need to be, you know, we need to stop making the feel-good statements. Like, feels great to say, we're going to make every child college ready. No, we're not. There is a reality that there are some children that don't have the capacity to go to college. Whether we want to admit it or not, no matter what program we give them, they don't have the capacity. That doesn't mean they can't be productive. It doesn't mean there aren't things we can teach them to give them at least the entrance to a middle-income lifestyle. But, you know, just the rhetoric isn't going to fix it. Just telling a child who doesn't have the capacity that he's going to take algebra and he's going to have to pass it. He's not going to pass it. Or we're going to water the course down so much that it really isn't algebra. And all we're going to do is frustrate him out of school rather than work to keep him in school and educate him to the best of his ability. You know, that would be nice, but we're going to have to get past the rhetoric of, you know, the silver bullet. We're going to hold teachers accountable and they're going to make every child go to college. Not going to happen.
Okay. Gail Fallon, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Okay.